This particular grouping of cardinals, I think, are very much going to want to continue that vision that the Pope has.
The Pope opens his ninth papal consistory in Rome as he adds to the body of cardinals who will help decide the future leadership of the Catholic Church.
Our national vital interest is in degrading the Russian military.
Seven candidates take to the stage as they audition to become the next Republican presidential nominee. Missing from the debate, former President Donald Trump, polling ahead of all of them by wide margins.
Over my shoulder, you can see the iconic bonnet that Elizabeth Ann Seton wore. It's the only known part of her habit.
And understanding the first American-born Catholic saint, we take you to a new interactive museum designed to teach pilgrims about the amazing life of Saint Elizabeth Ann Seton. EWTN News In Depth starts now. The scene this weekend will look similar to this last papal consistory, as Pope Francis continues to cement his legacy, selecting new like-minded cardinals who will eventually choose his successor. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. It appears the future is on Pope Francis's mind. This weekend's consistory, creating 21 new cardinals, comes on the eve of the start of the Synod on Synodality in Rome, in which the life of the Church and evangelization will be discussed. From our Vatican Bureau, Colin Flynn explains why this consistory, putting Francis's cardinals increasingly front and center, is so significant.
In the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, after Pope Francis, the head of the Church, the next most senior title someone can have is cardinal.
The cardinals are chosen by the Pope to be his sort of inner council, as it were, to give him consultation and an advice on how to help run the Church. The second reason is because the cardinals are the ones who will elect the next Pope as well, so their position is very important in that regard.
The cardinals are personally chosen by the Pope. He alone has the power to make someone a cardinal.
They help him to govern the Catholic Church, and so the Pope might choose people for whom he has, you know, great esteem or whom he has heard good things about. It's up to the Pope's discretion to choose who he wants in his College of Cardinals.
There are two key groups of cardinals, electors and non-electors. Only cardinals under the age of 80 are permitted to vote in a conclave for the next pope, as the rule is once a cardinal turns 80 years old, they are called non-electors and no longer allowed to take part.
Cardinals who are over 80 or who, you know, they were made cardinals before they turned 80 and then they turned 80, it's kind of an honor, especially those who are created cardinal after they've already turned 80. They already know they're not going to participate in a future conclave.
Yeah, the over 80 cardinal choices are really because they've distinguished themselves in some way and they've given a long service to the Church.
And what makes the cardinals even more important is not only will they select the next pope, but he will almost certainly come from within the group with no age limit, meaning any one of them could be picked. The last time a non-cardinal was elected pope was in 1378. At the moment, there are 221 cardinals in the world. Of them, 119 are allowed to vote for the next pope as they are under 80. With this new consistory, Pope Francis will create 21 new cardinals, of which 18 are under 80 and so will have a vote in the next conclave until they too turn 80. This means that Pope Francis will have created 121 cardinals from 66 countries. That's 55% of all the cardinals. And of the ones who can vote, Pope Francis will have created 98 of them. That's 72% of the cardinal electors.
Pope Francis has had 9 consistories out of 10 years, which is way more than any other pope before in the modern age. Just think that John Paul II had 9 consistory to create new cardinals in 27 years. So it's way more.
An expression has been used that Pope Francis is flooding the College of Cardinals. or in other words, stacking the decks with men who share in his vision and hopes for the future of the church, cementing his legacy.
What it means is that the Pope, I think because he's getting to the end probably of his pontificate, that he wants to bring in as many like-minded cardinals as he can, just in case, you know, he gets called to the Lord at some point in the next few years. So he's got the College of Cardinals set up to choose a successor who'd be probably more like him.
So with Pope Francis and this upcoming consistory, who are the type of men he is selecting to become cardinal, and where are they from?
This pope, compared to other popes, has traditionally chosen less of those archbishops who are kind of expected to become cardinals. There are those archdioceses in the world that traditionally always had a cardinal as the head, and he has instead chosen men from many different places in the world, and often places that have never had countries that have never had a cardinal before.
The home countries of the cardinals are changing too, with Pope Francis selecting more from parts of the world never before having a cardinal.
Pope Francis had already changed this and made it much broader. I mean, it used to be that the College of Cardinals was mainly even just European bishops. So the fact that now we have cardinals spread out all over the world, I mean, even, you know, a cardinal in Mongolia, for example, there's only a small Catholic population there.
From Mongolia to South Sudan, another one of the new cardinals that will be created is Stephen Aminu Martin Mullah.
Another interesting thing would be, you know, the creation as a cardinal of the Archbishop of Juba in South Sudan, because South Sudan is a place very dear to the Pope, and Cardinal Parolin went back to South Sudan in August, so there is a sort of very high level of interest in the country by the Holy See.
He's also chosen, I think, three cardinals from the Global South who aren't usually chosen. I think in this particular consistory, I think most of them are very much following the Pope Francis's vision for the church, and that's why they've been chosen.
Another important cardinal elect is Bishop Stephen Chow Sai Yang from Hong Kong.
There's the whole issue of growing closer relations with Beijing, and so I think he's seen as a very important, playing an important role in that. He's a Jesuit, so of course close to the Pope in that regard, and I think the Pope sees him as a natural ally in trying to increase or improve relations with China.
Pope Francis has said that these new cardinals represent the universality of the Catholic Church, one that he said he hopes will continue to proclaim God's love and mercy. The consistory, when they will be given their red hats, takes place this Saturday, September the 30th, in St. Peter's Basilica, here at the Vatican. In Rome, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
To talk more about this papal consistory happening right before the start of the upcoming Synod on Synodality, I'm joined by my colleague Jonathan Liddle, senior editor for the National Catholic Register. Jonathan, great to have you here. How's Rome?
It's great, Monsi. Great to be with you.
Great. Who are the most emblematic of Pope Francis's choices, the top three?
Well, Monsi, I think three is an important number because I think if we look at Pope Francis's consistory throughout his 10 years as Pope, we've seen three different criteria that the Pope has used to select his cardinals. So one of them, of course, we've just heard about is going to the peripheries, the geographic peripheries. Stephen Aminu Martin Mullah was mentioned as the first cardinal from South Sudan. But I want to highlight in this category also the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pier Battista Pizzaballa. So this is the leader of the Catholic community in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land, at a time of increased violence and oppression and even marginalization of Christians living in the state of Israel. So Patriarch Pizzaballa has been a kind of strong voice for Christians in the Holy Land. So Pope Francis seems to be going to these people on the peripheries, Christians who are a minority in their country and facing oppression. So clearly a sign of support for them. Another criteria that the Pope likes to use, I think, when he picks his cardinals are people who he's met in person and been impressed with. They've collaborated with him. They've worked with him. So one person that comes to mind here, a new cardinal, is Cardinal Americo Aguiar, a Portuguese prelate who was actually in charge of World Youth Day Lisbon. And in that capacity, He met with the Pope to discuss the vision for that event. And World Youth Day Lisbon was really, in many ways, Pope Francis's magisterium put into action. So his document on human fraternity, Fratelli Tutti, was a key cornerstone. So was Laudato Si on the environment. So it seems that the Pope was impressed with Cardinal Aguiar's work at World Youth Day, and has given him the red hat. And at only 49 years old, it might be a sign of bigger things to come for the Portuguese cardinal. And then finally, the Pope loves to pick cardinals who represent his theological vision. And I think you can have no more emphatic of a statement in that regard than Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, fellow Argentinian, a long history of friendship and collaboration with Pope Francis, his theological advisor, his ghostwriter on some of his most important papal documents. The Pope made now Cardinal Fernandez the head of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, a very important office in Rome, where he's been charged with really kind of implementing, applying Pope Francis's magisterium. So those are three names that I think show the three different criteria that the Pope sometimes uses when picking his cardinals.
It seems that these appointments are keeping with his promise to represent the marginalized as well. Well, let's look at what Pope Francis is doing to outpace other popes in recent history. He's called 9 consistories in 10 years. Has any other pope called this many in so few years?
No, Monsi, this has really become a hallmark of Pope Francis, the number of consistories, the number created, and of course, this consistory on September 30th, 21 cardinals created, which is the most during his pontificate. So the size of the College of Cardinals, of course, has swelled to 136, which is beyond the normal precedent. And it's also at the same time, though, that the Pope has expanded the size of the College of Cardinals, and it has expanded the geographic diversity. It's very interesting to note that there have only been 2 instances of the College of Cardinals meeting before these 9 consistories. And these pre-consistory meetings are oftentimes where the College of Cardinals, coming from different parts of the world, they can get to know each other. They can talk about issues in the life of the church. So you have this interesting dynamic where more cardinals than ever before from all parts of the world, but less opportunities perhaps to know each other, which in the event of a future conclave could definitely have an impact.
That's definitely necessary. Well, the cardinal-elect from Hong Kong, Cardinal Stephen Chow, said something after a press event yesterday that is either politically correct or worrisome, or a take on Pope Francis's desire for us to be good Christian witnesses rather than rely on proselytism. He said, this is the cardinal, evangelization in China today should focus on communicating the love of God without the agenda of turning them into Catholics. What do you make of these comments?
Yeah, well, I think a lot probably hinges on the meaning of the word agenda and turning them into Catholics. I think in some sense it does echo a longstanding theme of Pope Francis's, which you mentioned, which is that we need to evangelize, not proselytize. Evangelization attracts, evangelization proposes, where proselytization imposes. And it could be that Cardinal Chow is simply saying, you know, the goal isn't to just force someone to become Catholic, but really by the beauty of your life to attract them, right? The holiness of the saints and the holiness that hopefully we're living in our lives. But certainly in the backdrop of a comment like that is the situation for religious liberty in China, which of course is very difficult. And it can be very difficult to express and live the Catholic faith fully there as well. So it might be one of those comments, Monsi, where you can kind of read it how you want to read it. And maybe Cardinal Chow said it that way. Precisely for that reason.
Yeah, something on purpose. Well, now I can't let you leave without asking you about the synod, which starts on Wednesday, October 4th, and the retreat the bishops are all attending before it opens. What can you tell us about the events of the coming days?
That's right. The synod, a prayer vigil, an ecumenical prayer vigil in St. Peter's Square on the evening of September 30th, and then a spiritual retreat for the 450 or so participants led by the British Dominican priest Timothy Radcliffe and the Italian nun Maria Ignazia Angelini. So beginning in prayer, but then getting right into it on October 4th, a mass celebrated by the Pope and public statements by key synodal figures such as Cardinal Mario Grech and the General Relator Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich. But that's that's kind of the public beginning. And then we dive into about 4 weeks of behind closed doors discussion and synodal proceedings. So a lot going on here in the Vatican.
Well, we'll be looking to you and the team there to keep us up to date. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Muncie.
There's much more ahead on today's program, from Iraq to Azerbaijan to Emmitsburg, Maryland, to a presidential debate across the country in California.
And if you're pro-life, you have to be pro-life for the entire life, not just the 9 months in the womb.
Abortion, the economy, foreign policy, crime. Seven Republican candidates take on the tough issues in the second GOP presidential primary debate.
Her life is very inspiring, I think, and I think it will be a source of hope and encouragement for many people.
And honoring the memory of a great American saint, Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore blesses a new museum in Maryland dedicated to the life of Saint Elizabeth Ann Seton. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
Where's Joe Biden? He's completely missing in action from leadership. And you know who else is missing in action? Donald Trump is missing in action. He should be on this stage tonight. He owes it to you to defend his record.
The second Republican presidential debate this week held at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. But conspicuously absent from the stage, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. The debate on Wednesday night saw candidates jockeying to answer questions out of turn, often talking over each other to get camera time. All of them need to make gains in the polls to stop what appears to be a Trump steamroll. Mark Irons has our report.
The former president, he's missing in action tonight.
While facing federal felony charges, former President Donald Trump continues to hold a commanding lead in polling among Republican White House hopefuls. After skipping the first debate last month, he saw no need to take part in the second GOP presidential debate this week. Some fellow Republicans have accused Trump of ducking his responsibilities to voters.
And let me tell you what's going to happen. You keep doing that, no one up here is going to call you Donald Trump anymore. We're going to call you Donald Duck.
Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been a consistent critic of the Republican frontrunner, but now Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is calling him out as well. In a recent NBC interview, Trump said Florida's six-week ban on abortion signed by Governor DeSantis was a terrible mistake.
He's had a lot to say about that. He should be here explaining his comments to try to say that pro-life protections are somehow a terrible thing.
Some have found it more effective to pull their punches when speaking about the former president. Entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy may hope to draw Trump supporters to his campaign.
I think Trump was an excellent president. But the America First agenda does not belong to one man. It does not belong to Donald Trump. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to you.
But there's one Republican Ramaswamy isn't impressing.
Honestly, every time I hear you, I feel a little bit dumber for what you say.
Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, critical as the political newcomer, has tried to capture the attention of young voters. Ramaswamy recently appeared in a TikTok video with a social media influencer. But Haley says it's China that has too much influence over TikTok and user data, which poses a security risk.
You're now wanting kids to go and get on the social media that's dangerous for all of us. You went and you were in business with the Chinese that gave Hunter Biden $5 million. We can't trust you.
All Republican candidates are trying to win the trust of voters. U.S. Senator Tim Scott said building up the country starts with families.
If you want to restore hope, you've got to restore the family, restore capitalism, and put Americans back at work together as one American family.
Among the debate topics, education, health care, and crime. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum touting his record in his state.
But the reason why we're not talking about education or health care or safety being a problem in North Dakota is because we have a business leader. I've got more experience as a business leader than I think this whole group combined. I know I've created more jobs than everybody else on stage.
Former Vice President Mike Pence said he has the needed political experience to become the next commander in chief and the plans to fight major problems like gun violence.
I am sick and tired of these mass shootings happening in the United States of America. And if I'm president of the United States, I'm going to go to the Congress of the United States, and we're going to pass a federal expedited death penalty for anyone involved in a mass shooting.
Pence, a vocal Christian, may support the death penalty, but it is opposed by Catholic teaching. The Catechism of the Catholic Church states, the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person. Catholic Governor Ron DeSantis supports the death penalty in Florida. He's also an advocate for unborn babies. DeSantis says he'd support a national 15-week abortion ban if he became president. In years past, Catholic Chris Christie has also shared his support of the death penalty. On the debate stage, he provided this perspective on his pro-life views.
If you're pro-life, you have to be pro-life for the entire life, not just the 9 months in the womb. We need to make sure that for the drug-addicted 16-year-old on the floor of the county lockup, her life is precious too.
School choice and parental involvement in education was also discussed at this week's debate.
And really bring in that parental involvement, that's when we'll start to see a difference. But we've got to get parents back included.
And parental rights to know how children choose to identify in schools also came up. A broader conversation about gender continues across America.
I have to be very clear about this. Transgenderism, especially in kids, is a mental health disorder. We have to acknowledge the truth of that for what it is.
The next Republican debate will take place in November. Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
That next debate will be on DeSantis and Trump home turf. The matchup is scheduled for November 8th in Miami, Florida. All of the candidates will have to meet an increasingly higher threshold in the polls and in donor dollars to make the cut. Stay with EWTN News as we continue coverage of the 2024 presidential election, the debates, candidate interviews, polling, and analysis from a Catholic perspective. Coming up next, the Christian community in Iraq mourns those lost in a freak fire at a wedding celebration, and a humanitarian crisis and mass exodus as Azerbaijan takes control of a once autonomous zone populated by ethnic Armenians. Top news ahead in the Week in Review. A day of joy turned to horror after a deadly fire tore through a wedding venue. That story tops our Week in Review. It happened in the village of Karakosh, Iraq, a majority Christian town in the heart of the Nineveh Plains. Hundreds of people attended a funeral this week for some of the victims of the deadly wedding hall fire. Mourners carrying pictures of their lost loved ones cried as priests gave final blessings on the coffins of the dead. Some families lost as many as 10 relatives, including children. Witnesses say the fire started after large sparklers were lit during the bride and groom's dance. The flames of the sparklers caught onto the ceiling and decorations. The fire spread at lightning speed, engulfing the building in just moments. Fire rained down on the attendees as they ran to escape, and in minutes, portions of the building collapsed, leaving many trapped inside. Some 100 people were killed and 150 more injured, some with severe burns. The bride and groom survived. Only a shell of the building remains, with twisted and charred metal and debris that collapsed onto the floor. Families are seeking justice after Iraq's civil defense officials revealed that highly flammable and illegal building materials were used in the structure. Several arrests have been made, and many more may come. Archbishop Bashar Warda of Iraq issued a statement writing in part, "A wedding celebration in the ancient Nineveh village of Karakosh has turned into tragedy for Syriac Catholics. Patriarchs, bishops, and priests from all faiths gathered to bury those who had perished. No words can adequately describe the mourning of those bringing their loved ones to their final resting places in their ancient land. I ask for your prayers for those souls we have lost and the severely injured." Warda also says the tragedy has brought the people of Iraq together, with condolences from the Shia community, the government of Iraq, and Kurdistan announcing 3 days of mourning. A deadly explosion at a makeshift gas station in Nagorno-Karabakh killed at least 68 people and injured hundreds of others Monday night, as tens of thousands flee the region. It comes following Azerbaijan's blitz on the area last week. Armenian officials say more than 93,000 people have arrived in Armenia. That's more than 75% of the estimated 120,000 who were living in the Nagorno-Karabakh. Nagorno-Karabakh, which is also called Artsakh, was historically inhabited by Armenians for centuries. The region has been disputed between Armenia and Azerbaijan for the last three decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. The region that locals call the Republic of Artsakh is not officially recognized internationally. Before Azerbaijan's military attack on the region, the people suffered from a blockade of food and medical supplies by Azerbaijan for about 8 months. Meanwhile, the former minister of state of the self-proclaimed Republic of Artsakh, Ruben Vardanyan, was arrested by Azerbaijani authorities Wednesday while attempting to flee the region. He is charged with financing terrorism and other crimes. His wife is appealing for support to secure his release. And the president of Artsakh issued a decree on Thursday calling for all institutions and organizations of the republic, which, again, is not recognized internationally, to dissolve on January 1, 2024. Michael Rubin, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, is an expert on the region and has been following the developments closely. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Our viewers have been following the tragedy of the indigenous Christian population in Armenia. What is motivating the political reality, Turkey and Iran, that are backing Azerbaijan against Armenia?
Well, you know, some people might say this is just a diplomatic dispute over this territory called Nagorno-Karabakh. But the reason why so many people believe it's so much more is whenever Azerbaijan has gained possession of territory in which Christians live, they've destroyed churches, they've destroyed millennia-old graveyards. If you look at Azerbaijani school books, they describe the Christian community as a cancer which needs to be excised. This is why so many people in the region first, don't trust Azerbaijan when they say, don't worry, we'll protect you. And at the same time, believe that this really is the Armenian genocide version 2.0.
Yeah, it's very frightening. Well, let's get into that. What does the arrest of the former head of Nagorno-Karabakh signal for this conflict and the community there?
Well, it signals nothing good. Because remember, again, in the original Armenian genocide, in which over a million Armenians were killed back between 1915 and 1921-22, what started that Armenian genocide was the arrest of Armenian political leaders and intellectuals. And so many Armenians see a parallel to what we've seen in recent days with the arrest of the self-governing elected officials in this unrecognized country called Artsakh. Remember, none of these officials were accused of any violence, of any terrorism. They were just accused of representing their own publics. And if we look at Freedom House, which ranks countries based on democracy and dictatorship, Azerbaijan is among the worst dictatorships in the world. Artsakh, which has now been conquered, was counted as a democracy.
It was a big, big blow to the community there. Half of the population after the ceasefire has left. And Samantha Power, a genocide expert and current head of the USAID, was on the ground but refused to agree with the words of Armenia's prime minister, who has called the blitz on this autonomous zone ethnic cleansing. Do you agree with this assessment? And should other government leaders also be careful about labeling this ethnic cleansing?
No, this is ethnic cleansing. The most obvious example of it, Samantha Power, if I can be blunt, is showing herself to be an absolute coward here. The fact of the matter is she is doing everything which she criticized in her book, A Problem from Hell, which was a study of how the Americans had failed against the backdrop, for example, of genocide in Rwanda. So there's absolutely no excuse. The latest figures on the on the exodus from Artsakh is now close to 90,000 of the 120,000 Christians who are there. And I think it's only a matter of time until others leave. While Azerbaijan is saying, we're not forcing anyone to go, at the same time, there are on Telegram channels and other social media pictures of Armenian residents, of Christian residents, with Azerbaijanis offering to buy the women and the girls in a disgusting sort of parallel to what happened with the Yazidi genocide. Samantha Power is absolutely wrong and should be ashamed of herself.
Well, they're also just making it impossible to stay. So the United States and others are now pressing for a UN monitoring mission in the zone to make sure human rights are not being violated. Can we actually expect movement on this proposal?
Well, perhaps we'll get some movement on this, but the frustration is this is what the Armenians had been asking for the last few years. Why do people have to die? Why does one of the oldest Christian nations, this indigenous population in Artsakh, have to be ethnically cleansed in order for this to happen? If all the people of Artsakh are forced out, what exactly are the monitors going to be watching? So should there be monitors? Yes. Should that have happened? What have the American diplomats been doing in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, or Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, these past few years?
It's uncertain, but tell us then, what happens to the people who choose to stay? You describe the situation of these young girls, and also to the churches and the Christian cultural sites of great global significance.
Well, you're absolutely right. The cemetery in Julfa, which was destroyed, the Azerbaijanis denied doing it, but it's on video and their satellite imagery as well, had over 10,000 intricately carved, each unique cross stones. Some of them 800, 900, 1,000 years old, completely bulldozed. When you're bulldozing community heritage like that, that's a sign of genocide. That's not a sign of a political dispute. So what's going to happen to the people who remain? First of all, let's be clear. Azerbaijan has never controlled Nagorno-Karabakh before. It's always been self-governing. So this is different. The parallel is if China took over Taiwan, for example. Now, ordinary Azerbaijan says, we're going to give you the same rights as everyone else. But ordinary Azerbaijanis don't have any rights. Freedom House, again, categorizes Azerbaijan not only as a dictatorship, but a dictatorship on par with China and the Burmese military regime. They actually say that Azerbaijan has less freedom than Russia, Iran, and Cuba. That's not something in which most people who are used to a democracy are going to want to live.
So then what is your recommendation going forward? If the U.S. isn't going to act, who else is there?
Well, first of all, the United States continues to provide military assistance to Azerbaijan on the fiction that Azerbaijan isn't going to use it against the Armenians. We see, I mean, television cameras don't lie in this case. Close to 90,000 out of the 120,000 residents of Artsakh have already fled. So why are we subsidizing this? At the same time, U.S. law suggests that there's something called the Humanitarian Assistance Corridors Act, which says that any country, and Azerbaijan is a case in point, that refuses to allow the distribution of U.S. Aid should itself be sanctioned. There's no waiver for that. Then there's Magnitsky Act sanctions. Who are the people who have beheaded the Armenians, who have destroyed the churches? Why aren't we bringing those up on sanctions? Why should they be able to come to Disney World with their families? And the fact of the matter is we have so many policy arrows in our quiver, but we're not taken seriously because we simply don't want to stand up to the dictator.
Well, it looks like we've got a lot of work to do to get awareness going. We're so grateful for your analysis, and I hope you'll join us again as we stay on top of this developing story. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
Deadly violence in Haiti is expanding across the nation, according to a United Nations report released Wednesday. It indicates more than 2,700 people were killed between October of 2022 and June of this year. Cases of kidnappings and rapes are also rising. Gangs now control more than 80% of Port-au-Prince. Their violent activities have expanded to other major cities. The report comes as the U.S. and Kenya signed a defense agreement on Monday to provide resources for Kenyan forces to lead a peacekeeping mission to Haiti to combat gang violence. A somber milestone for pro-democracy activist Jimmy Lai, who marked 1,000 days in a Hong Kong prison on Tuesday. The billionaire media tycoon and Catholic convert was arrested in December 2020 under Hong Kong's national security law. He is facing several charges, including collusion with foreign forces. Lai, a British citizen, was the publisher of a pro-democracy newspaper, The Apple Daily, which the Chinese government raided and shut down. He is held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day, according to the Associated Press. His son has shared concerns that his 75-year-old father could die in prison. Lai's trial has repeatedly been pushed back. If convicted, he could face life in prison. Pope Francis reiterated his compassion for migrants during his weekly audience with the faithful in St. Peter's Square. Describing his visit to Marseille last weekend for a meeting to discuss the Mediterranean, the Holy Father insisted migrants crossing the sea to arrive in Europe must be welcomed. Many have died in dangerous journeys, fleeing war and violence in their homelands.
The Mediterranean is the cradle of civilization, and a cradle is for life. It is not tolerable that it becomes a tomb, neither should it be a place of conflict.
Francis urged migrants be integrated into the community, saying their cultures and philosophies can be seen as an opportunity rather than a burden to help revitalize Western societies where young people often show little hope for the future. We'll be back in a moment.
These are important tools that you can also use in addition to our books to help raise your Catholic family in the faith.
It's Hispanic Heritage Month. We'll take a look at a faith-based company catering to the needs of Spanish-speaking children as we take a look at the growth of Hispanic businesses in America. We'll be right back.
Across the U.S., we celebrate National Hispanic Heritage Month from mid-September to mid-October with a look at how Latino Americans have contributed to our country. A new report from the Small Business Administration finds nearly one in four new businesses in America is Hispanic-owned. Those nearly 5 million businesses across the country generate more than $800 billion for the U.S. economy. We feature one of those new businesses now. Hispanic and Catholic-owned, Theotokos Kids is a unique company designed to spread the gospel to children with books in both English and Spanish. To discuss her children's faith-based books, we're joined by publisher Veronica Caballero of Theotokos Kids. Veronica is also an EWTN colleague. She's part of our outreach team working as a bilingual content creator. Veronica, it's great to have you here with us to talk about your company and your books. You and your husband started this publishing company 2 years ago. What motivated you to do this?
Yeah, Monse, I'd like to begin by saying it's a complete honor to be here with you and to be able to share about this incredible project with our EWTM family. Yes, we began this endeavor 2 years ago, and what motivated us was a need that we saw in our own Catholic family. Our oldest was 9 months old to a year old, and she was diving into board books. I bought her a beautifully illustrated a pricey Catholic board book. There weren't many on the market at the time, and it was a picture book. And she was reading through it, and I think the first time that she read through it, she ripped out one of the pages, and I took it away from her at once, and I said, we'll take this back out in 10 years. But obviously, I was sad because I wanted her to receive this formation, and I wanted her to be able to enjoy these beautiful illustrations on the faith, but she wasn't able to because of her age level. That was one. And then another one was, even though we stumbled upon some Catholic resources, Catholic books, none of them were in Spanish. And two priorities for us were very important in raising our children, sharing the beauty of our Catholic faith and sharing our Latino culture. And so it was very difficult for me to read stories to her and having to translate on the spot. It was uncomfortable for her. It was a little strange for me. And so we knew that we needed some resources in Spanish because we only speak to our girls in Spanish at home. And so thus was born Theotokos Kids.
Now, why Theotokos?
Theotokos because my family has always been very Marian. When we got married, my husband and I, we went to Our Lady of the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City to consecrate our marriage to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And everything that we do is for her, for her son, through her intercession, through her, for her, with her and in her. And so if we started this endeavor, we knew that it wanted to be for her as well. And then also Theotokos is Greek for the Mother of God. And so how fitting that this name would be Mother of God, a ministry for little ones.
Right.
And so that she would be able to help Catholic parents raise their little ones in the faith through this ministry as well. And so, and we wanted it to be fun. So we could have just called it Theotokos Kids, but we wanted it to be fun. And so
yeah.
It's Theotokos.
I love that so much. I love the spirit of what you're doing. You're an American company that is trying to meet the needs of the Hispanic community, especially young Latino families. How is Theotokos part of this necessary outreach that the church and the laity need to provide?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So in just some recent research that I've been doing, and now with it being National Hispanic Heritage Month, some research that I've done from Dr. Hoffman Ospina from Boston College, the Department of Theology from Boston College. He has said that 71% of the growth of the U.S. Catholic Church since 1960 has been Hispanics. Hispanics account for 40% of the 78 million Catholics in the U.S. And in the U.S., 60% of Catholics under the age of 18 are Hispanic.
Yes.
And so these are incredible numbers when we learn them. And it's even more incredible or alarming to know that the resources for Hispanic Catholics, for this large growing community in the Catholic Church, are zero to none. There are almost no resources for Hispanic Catholics to be able to grow in their faith, to be able to lead the church in the future, to be able to lead, you know, the church to heaven, and even less for children. And so just being a Hispanic Catholic family here in the U.S., we saw this need and we knew that something had to be done about it. And we joyfully answered the call, and we're joyfully here creating more resources for families just like ours that have the same need that we do.
Absolutely, an important need. Well, you have a new Marian collection featuring Our Lady of Guadalupe and Our Lady of Fatima. Why do you think these two apparitions are key to passing on the faith to children?
We do. So Our Lady of Guadalupe is a patroness of the Americas. She's deeply beloved by Hispanic Catholics all over the world, but even more so in the U.S. And so we knew that this had to be one of our first books that we launched in the Marian collection. Also because she's near and dear to our heart. Like I mentioned, we consecrated our marriage to her on our honeymoon. And then Our Lady of Fatima is actually a personal favorite apparition of mine. When we found out we were expecting our second little girl, we went on pilgrimage to Our Lady of Fatima and chose her name after Lucia of Fatima. Her name is Luciana, our second little girl. And so the messages that come about from these two apparitions are beautiful ones that I'm excited to share with little ones. Each of our books focus on a central theme or virtue or foundation, basis of our faith, in a theologically appropriate way for little ones. And so the message of Our Lady of Guadalupe is that of trust in our Blessed Mother, teaches little ones to really trust in her and love her and fall in love with her in a tender way, just like St. Juan Diego did. And then the message of Our Lady of Fatima is one of listening to our Blessed Mother, heeding to her call in the messages that she gives Our Lady of Fatima, and to pray the rosary daily. And so these are two important messages that I'm excited to share with little ones all over.
If you would like to find out more about Theotokos Kids or support their efforts to help educate children, a Kickstarter campaign is underway through the end of this weekend. Find out more at www.kickstarter.com and search for Theotokos Kids. When we return, a new way to remember St. Elizabeth Ann Seton.
And the Vatican Museums open up the famed Borgia apartment to show off the renovated work of a 15th century master artist. Images of the week ahead.
We would love everyone to come and visit the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton and experience this amazing new visitor center and museum.
EWTN News is there for the dedication ceremony of a new museum on the life of the first American-born Catholic saint. In the small town of Emmitsburg, Maryland, home to a Catholic seminary, a Catholic university, a retirement home for retired religious, and the Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton is a brand new facility. Its modern interactive exhibits are designed to help teach new generations about the Catholic faith of an American original, the first American to be canonized by the Catholic Church. Reporter Rizal Regis takes us there.
Providence has disposed for me a plan after my own heart. It is expected I will become the mother of many daughters.
St. Elizabeth Ann Seton was a woman of her time, a convert to Catholicism after enduring much suffering in her life. A pioneer, opening one of the first free Catholic schools in America for girls. A foundress, establishing the first order of women religious in the U.S., and the first American-born saint.
St. Elizabeth Ann Seton is someone that I think many, many people can relate to. As a child who faced rejection, as a young woman who fell in love and married, as a wife, as a mother, and then as a foundress of a religious community, throughout all the stages of her life, her fidelity to God and to those that she served is a remarkable example of faith and courage.
St. Elizabeth Ann Seton died 201 years ago, but devotees like Sister Chris Maggie believe she serves as an inspiration to so many people. And now her legacy has been brought to life with a new museum at the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton in Emmitsburg, Maryland.
These are the holy grounds where she came in 1809 with her children and first sisters. She established the first women's religious community in the United States, the Sisters of Charity of St. Joseph's. Sisters then went out from these grounds all over the country and established orphanages, schools, and hospitals.
Rob Judge is the executive director of the Shrine. He explains that the goal of the years-long project to renovate the museum is to enhance the experience for pilgrims who want to learn more about St. Elizabeth Ann Seton.
For those who don't know Elizabeth Ann Seton, they'll have a great introduction to who she was and is, so that as a saint, she can be their friend, she can be an intercessor. For those who know something about Elizabeth Ann Seton, hopefully they come and discover another aspect of her rich history and her faith.
The new visitor center and museum cost $4 million and is the first significant renovation of the museum in 40 years. Program Director Tony DiUlio helped design the galleries that tell St. Elizabeth Ann's story from childhood to sainthood. He said it all started with an interpretive plan.
What does this mean? Why is this thing important in this place to these people? That interpretive plan guided us in terms of what story we want to tell, and in terms of how we want to tell it, identifying our audiences, and then lining those things up.
The exhibits feature artifacts, digital interactive exhibits, hands-on activities, and DiUlio's favorite, St. Elizabeth Ann's personal writings.
One of the things I treasure most here is what we call Mother Seton's commonplace books, or her copybooks. We have three of her copybooks, and they're going to be displayed on rotation here. Visitors can come and look through her most intimate writings.
The museum chronicles her life into three core galleries: Seeker, Servant, and Saint.
Here we have the most iconic object in the museum, which is Mother Seton's shawl and bonnet.
As archivist and historian for the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati, Sister Judith Metz had a part in the fruition of the new museum. She hopes that St. Elizabeth Ann Seton's story can help others grow in their faith.
One of the main things for me about Elizabeth Seton's life is her evolution of her faith and her deepening spirituality and connection to God through her, you know, her evolving life. For visitors, I hope that they can find a real connection to her and be helped, in a sense, by her own spirituality to grow in their spirituality.
And that's exactly the connection Jackie Abetamarco felt with a saint. Like St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, Abetamarco is a convert to Catholicism. During her battle with cancer, she looked to the saint's unwavering faith as a testament of God's love. On the opening day of the museum, she and her husband visited the shrine for the first time.
I felt the closeness to her, the way that with Catholic traditions made her feel closer to God. I'm the same way.
You get a sense of her journey through pain and suffering, and how that relationship with God got her through that, to do what she did.
People should stop and see the shrine and come visit the shrine if they can, and pray and thank God every day for the blessings that he gives to all of us.
St. Elizabeth Ann Seton also serves as someone the younger generation aspires to be. Meet yes. Judy Delp and Felicity Crook.
I'm Ruby Delp, and I portray the student of Mother Seton, Anna Mae Mater. She went to this school here at the Seton Shrine.
And my name is Felicity Crook, and I don't have my character yet.
Felicity is new on the team and is learning from Ruby how to become a junior history interpreter. On the grounds of the shrine, two historic homes remain open, the Stone House where St. Elizabeth Ann Seton lived and the White House where she taught. These young interpreters portray the life of the early students in the academy and interact with the public during tours.
I think it's cool to be like standing in the place where she would have stood. I love walking in her footsteps and sharing her life and legacy with others as I'm here each day.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
In addition to the permanent exhibits, the museum also debuted two special exhibits about early American needlework and the iconic clothing of the Daughters of Charity. For more information on the new St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Museum, go to this website, www.setonshrine.org. And finally today, a glimpse inside the beautifully renovated Borgia apartment at the Vatican. Known as the Hall of Liberal Arts, the study of Pope Alexander VI was decorated by the famed Renaissance artist Pinturicchio between 1492 and 1494. Our EWTN photographer went on tour, courtesy of the Vatican Museums. Enjoy these images of the week. And that's our program for today. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us for the next edition of EWTN News in Depth. Same time next week. More news then with reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.